Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Frederick Douglass, 1818 to 1895, is revered as an abolitionist, statesman, orator, reformer, essayist, and autobiographer. But it is less commonly known that he was also a steward of the arts. In this presentation, held on October 2, 2017, as part of the Works in Progress lecture series at the National Gallery of Art, Kamal McLaren traces Douglass's love of art through his personal collection preserved at Cedar Hill, his Anacostia home, from 1877 until his death in 1895. The house is furnished much as it was during Douglass's lifetime, with paintings and photographs depicting people and places significant to the family and to African American history. Sarah Cash discusses Douglass's interest in the Corcoran Gallery of Art collection, using contemporary diary entries and newspaper articles, as well as museum catalogs and works of art kept at Cedar Hill.
It's truly an honor and pleasure to be here with you guys today, presenting my research on Frederick Douglass. I sort of spent a lot of time with him on a daily basis, and being able to present what I discover and what I see is a great thing in terms of, sort of disseminating it to the public. I always start out with this question. Who do you know Frederick Douglass to be? I mean, do you guys have a general idea who Frederick Douglass was? All right. It's an engaging thing, so you can sort of yell out here. Who was Frederick Douglass? Absolutely, yes. Anybody else? Yes.
Abolitionists,
yes. You can't talk about Frederick Douglass without talking about his abolitionist days, right? What else? Yes, ma'am.
A great writer and orator and a great campaigner for black men to fight for freedom in the Civil War.
Absolutely. Anything else?
Ambassador,
yes. Yes, he was the ambassador, what we deem as the ambassador to Haiti. Matter of fact, be on the lookout for a documentary that probably will be published in 2019 by a State Department diplomat by the name of Christopher Teal. Basically, he's looking at Douglass's time in Haiti with his mentee, which was Ebenezer Bassett. And Ebenezer Bassett was the first African-American to be a ambassador or diplomat for the United States in Haiti. And it was just an interesting relationship because Frederick Douglass was Ebenezer Bassett's mentor for so many years. And then when Douglass became the ambassador to Haiti, Ebenezer Bassett became his mentor because he had already got the lay of the land in terms in Haiti. Anything else you want to add? Who else? When you think of Frederick Douglass, what comes to mind?
Leader.
All right. Excellent. Yes, ma'am.
Photographs. He was a masterful user of imagery.
Absolutely. The great book that just been published last year was this idea of Douglass and imagery and how he used it for the cause of abolitionism and how important it was. And always like to point out any image that you see of Frederick Douglass, he's looking very stoic, very serious. And that sort of segues into another lighter side of Douglass that I always like to point out, or what my research is finding is Douglass loved art. And I always say that Douglass was a man for many seasons. He was truly the embodiment of what we deem as a Victorian gentleman. He loved all the quote-unquote hobbies of quote-unquote manliness, and also there was a lighter side because he was a woman suffragist. He loved advocating for women's rights. So Mr. Douglass really, when you look at his life over the course of his 77 years, there's a tremendous complexity about who he was, and one of his passions was his love of art. And this gentleman here is Francis Grimke, who actually was the minister who married he and his second wife, Miss Helen Pitts Douglass. And he spent a lot of time with Mr. Douglass in and around the city, as well as at his estate, Cedar Hill. How many of you guys have ever been to Cedar Hill? All right. Okay, so this, so we're going to try to bring Cedar Hill to life to you today. But in memory of Mr. Douglas, a month shy after Mr. Douglas would pass away. Mr. Douglas would pass away at 77 on February 20th, 1895. And in March, Francis Grimke remembers that Douglas loved the beautiful in art and in nature. And that quote really stuck out to me because what we find is Douglas truly did love art, but he also loved nature. And his love of nature intersected with his love of art. So you can't talk about Douglas without talking about the two of those passions that Douglas shared over the course of his life or carried out. And what we find is Cedar Hill being sort of a historic space, or back then would have been his domestic space, he really tries to communicate through his material culture those two passions, which is his love of nature and love of art. And it's sort of the sort of, as I state earlier, these tangible proofs as evidence. But last year, it was highlighted earlier that this talk and this research really came about when we looked at Douglas and art for last year's birthday celebration. Every year we celebrate Mr. Douglas's birth. And what you'll find is, being a tremendous patron of the arts, Mr. Douglas really engaged art in many of its forms, right down to collecting instruments, going to the Boston Symphony Orchestra. When he traveled overseas, he would always find time to go to the museums and take in the museum material culture there. And Mr. Douglas was a self-taught violinist, and we see that being portrayed, him admiring his own grandson, Joseph, who was a classical violinist in his own right. He was basically trained at the New England Conservatory in Boston. And you see the Boston connection of the Boston Symphony. And he would receive his first lesson from Grandpa Fred at Cedar Hill. All right. And Douglas, the way Douglas saw art was very telling. He says, "Let the world be filled with music and pure works of art, pictures, images, and other symbolic representation. It speaks to the imagination." And one of the visitors in the back talked about Douglas's use of photography and imagery. So here he is talking about how pictures and images and other works of art, even music. So Mr. Douglas engaged in so the musical aspects of art in terms of what art can be constructed through music instruments, as well as what we think of in terms of images and artworks. And those artworks can be seen at Cedar Hill in many ways, and it sort of allows us to really understand who Mr. Douglas was. And I always say that the walls at Cedar Hill are adorned with bounties of art. And when you guys, for those that have traveled to Cedar Hill or took the Mecca, as a lot of people would say, do you guys recall the artworks that were on the wall? Okay. All right. Many of them on all floors. So if you were to come into Douglas's Cedar Hill, you would have been greeted at the door by a doorman, but then you would have been captivated by sort of observing in the formal and informal spaces of these artworks. And they probably would have been great conversational pieces, and Douglas would have definitely took time to really engage you in those conversations about his artwork that he collected over the years. And you'll see here several different forms of art here. And then this is a present photograph today there. And right down to the actual rocker, even the artworks carved in the actual furnishings, Mr. Douglas would receive that rocker from the citizens of Haiti after he finished his stint as the ambassador from 1889 to 1891. And here is in sort of what we deem as the West Parlor or the informal space. So this is where he would have took instruments and engaged his family members through taking up the violin. There is actually a tambourine in the room that was actually brought back from Haiti. So here's Douglass once again, in a physical sense, engaging art through forms of instrumentation. And you'll see the violin on the West Parlor, and there's numerous of, stories of Douglass engaging his guest and having them partake in singing and dancing in this informal space. And other forms of artwork here you'll see throughout the home. And the dining room is another space where Douglass spent a lot of time with his guest, entertaining around that dining room table. And also you'll see other forms of art on the wall. And what we find is these artworks really can be categorized around three themes, sort of floriculture, botanical paintings, really demonstrating Douglass's love of nature. And I said how nature and his love of art intertwine or is sort of interlinked. The seascapes that you're going to see as we sort of progress through the presentation act as these sort of mental and physical metaphors or symbols of Douglass's own transition from slavery to freedom. And we'll go in depth a little bit on those as we proceed forward. But another theme is landscapes. So if you had to sort of observe all the artworks in Cedar Hill, those are the three themes that they sort of align with here. And if we sort of look at the first slide, this is sort of the Douglass's emotional connection to nature. Mr. Douglass really admired these two paintings because they were actually painted by two of his friends. The one on the left, for example, is done by Sarah Eady, and she actually did that oil painting of Frederick Douglass we saw early on the early slide. And so she sort of touches on and demonstrates Douglass's love of dandelions, and dandelions grew on Cedar Hill. And something as simple as dandelions, Mr. Douglass took an emotional connection to. And then he loved ferns. You'll see right down into the wallpaper in many ways. In the East and West Parlor, you'll see his connection with Haiti there. And Mr. Douglass was a continuous flower presser. He collected a lot of plant life here domestically and internationally. A lot of plant life we discovered was from the Caribbean, even as far as England. He would sort of bring that back and store it very delicately in his traveling trunk. And two things I'm highlighting out is the trumpet creeper and sweet gum. And what's fascinating is engaging with these two plant life, it sort of shows us the connection that Douglass had with his both of his wives. Mr. Douglass was married twice over the course of his life. His first wife was Miss Anna Marie Douglass, who was a free person of color. And we often talk about Mr. Douglass married up in many ways. She would actually act as a conductor and help him escape from slavery. And they were married for 44 years. And the way they bonded with one another was to work in their gardens together. Every house that Douglass owned, he often always would have gardens, and he would always plant trees. And when she would pass away, he would remarry to Miss Helen Pitts Douglass. And they really enjoyed taking up the hobby of flower pressing. And we discovered that in our several books. The bulk of Douglass's collection is the many books that he owned. He owned about 3,000 books. And we discovered in numerous books a lot of the botanical specimens in and around on certain pages, and which we're still trying to do the research on that. So we see that art and nature were ways that he connected with his wives, plus going to the theater with his wives. And he actually, as Sarah going to highlight, they went to the Corcoran, which you can go in depth on that later. But the other one is the seascape. Mr. Douglass really saw the true embodiment of freedom was the water, the waterways. They can act as a form of freedom, or they can act as a form of resistance. And we see that time and time again through the paintings in his house. But Douglass quoted in his first narrative, and those gives us the clues of Douglass's love of the waterways. He says, "Countless sails moving off to the mighty sea always affected me powerfully. I pour out my soul's complaint to moving multitude of ships. You are loosed from your moorings and are free. I am fast in my chains, and I will take to the water. And in a context, this seascape, Douglas really sort of loved and engaged. It sort of represents the old Chateau d'Œuf that was highlighted in, you guys ever heard of Count of Monte Cristo? Right? So, and Douglas talks about his travels on his honeymoon with Miss Helen Pitts Douglas, actually helping an older gentleman being rolled out to see that that prison. And so we're constantly doing research. We think maybe a Robert Duncanson, this might be a Robert Duncanson work, but we haven't identified that yet. But the quote itself really comes from the primary source in terms of Douglas's own narrative. And it really captures his experience being shipped to Covey, who was a slave breaker, who was to sort of break Mr. Douglas of his spirit and his mind. And he talked about how he was on sort of the verge of losing his mind when he went to, at that stint, that year stint with Covey. And what he would do is he, on Sundays, he would actually find solace and peace by sort of staring out on the Chesapeake. And we find that this really provided him with sort of not going insane in many ways. And the other interesting twist in terms of a material culture object would be this canoe. Douglas, the original canoe was a wooden canoe, but another picture or painting in our collection is the one on the right. And you see that broad waterway, and it sort of captures the essence of the quote previously. But the canoe connection, Douglas using the canoe as well as the waterway in tandem in terms of this freedom and resistance. And he has a great quote. He says, "The very Chesapeake Bay shall yet bear me into freedom. The steamboat steered in a northeast course from North Point. I will do the same, and when I get to the head of the bay, I will turn my canoe adrift and walk straight through Delaware into Pennsylvania." So you can see how he's seeing waterways and a canoe or some form of ships as his form of resistance, inside, outside resistance and freedom. You guys ever heard of the steamer planter story and Robert Smalls? This image here is actually in the dining room. If we were to go back, it would be right by the next on the right of the fireplace. And this is an interesting story, and it sort of sends a sort of another metaphor and sort of a signal to us as a conversational piece if Douglas was entertaining guests. But Robert Smalls, who was a formerly enslaved person in South Carolina, he would actually, during the Civil War, he would take a Confederate ship, which was the steamer planter, and navigate it into Northern Territory and gain his freedom that way. So we see that outside of Douglas's experience, other formerly enslaved individuals saw waterways and freedoms and as a form of freedom and resistance. Another waterway that Douglas truly was smitten by and taken back was Niagara Falls. And it had a tremendous deep meaning to Mr. Douglas from a freedom standpoint as well as a resistance standpoint. And that it goes from left to right. When Mr. Douglas was a young abolitionist, he went to an abolitionist sort of conference up in near and around Rochester area before he would settle in Rochester. He basically experienced for the first time in person going to Niagara Falls. And what's fascinating is he would equate that experience with him actually touching down on free soil. So he would equate his experience with witnessing the Niagara Falls with his own experience of gaining his own freedom. And it's an excellent quote. He says, "An irresistible power closed my lips completely. Charmed, I stood with my eyes fixed, all absorbed. Scarcely conscious of my own existence, I felt the same way when my feet touched free soil and breathed free air. The ground trembled, the mighty rocks. I stood in solemn reverence. The awful God was there. He personally considered it to be the voice of nature, so august and impressive that it overwhelms the voice of art." Right. And then in terms of resistance, if we fast forward, as Mr. Douglas became his own conductor, became a conductor on the Underground Railroad when he moved to Rochester, starting the North Star. He would actually aid many enslaved people. It could have been Harriet Tubman bringing formerly enslaved people from this area on the eastern shore of Maryland up to his shop. And it was actually a family affair in terms of being conductors on the railroad. But he would use the suspension drawbridge from Rochester, from New York into Canada, and he would actually take enslaved people or, you know, over into freedom. So you see the sort of freedom and resistance juxtaposition there, metaphor. Landscapes. Mr. Douglas truly admired landscapes and rustic areas. It's not surprising that his final home, Cedar Hill, would be a rustic bullock space or landscape. He spent his last 17 years at Cedar Hill. And on his walls are these sort of rustic landscape paintings, which Douglas really was attracted to. And if you go back and really study his narrative, he talks about animal life and plant life and his experience when he was shipped to, quote unquote, being to be broke by Covey. He had a unique experience or a sort of a transformative experience, not only almost losing his mind, but he was actually beaten on a daily basis by Covey. And one of the first beatings that he received was he was tasked to go into the woods and get lumber or wood. And he had this clear and vivid experience with an oxen. Basically, he let the oxen get away from him, and that led to him being sort of lashed in many ways. And so we see those elements all throughout Cedar Hill as his connection with animal life. And Douglas was a Victorian farmer, and he had animal life on his actual estate. And one quote, he says, there is no successful farming without well-trained and well-trained oars as well as oxen. And one of the greatest pleasures connected with agricultural life may be found in the pleasant relationship capable of subsisting between farmer and his four-legged companions, for they are company as helpers in the toil. And the painting down at the bottom by Messer, the woodland scene of, at dusk, he purchased this a year before he would pass away. And everything, all roads lead back to his narrative. And when, as a child on the plantation, the Colonel Lloyd plantation, he was still young enough. He wasn't sent off to be a field hand until he was a teenager. But as a child, he actually, one of his duties was to actually herd the sheep out of the actual front yard. And we see that that theme sort of connects with him in later life, because he would purchase this and his connection with his engagement with animals. And on the east side of the alcoves of the east parlor, on the outside of the exterior of the home, you'll see these shepherd staffs and the star. And in a metaphor, Mr. Douglas was a shepherd for many causes throughout his life. And the things that you guys pointed out in terms of him being, number one, a leader, a great speaker, but he used his voice and pen to shepherd a lot of those causes, such as women's suffrage, abolition, and recruitment. So I'm going to end my talk and transition, we'll transition into Sarah's talk, which A Man Around the City, and she'll talk about how he engaged art at the Corcoran Art Gallery. So.
Thank you, Kamal, and hello, everyone. And thank you, Kamal, for the great sort of transitional slide into the next, the last short chapter of our joint presentation, which is definitely a work in progress. I did not know about any connection between Frederick Douglass and the Corcoran Gallery of Art until just about a year ago, when Kamal and one of his colleagues at the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site, Brittany O'Malley Hall, called my attention to an article that I'll tell you about in just a moment. And the story that I will tell you is a short story, but I think an interesting story, a Washington story about the Corcoran, and many of you in the audience might know the Corcoran best through not a recent photograph, but an older photograph, but in the flag building at the lower left. But the Corcoran's first home as an art museum, of course, is the building at the upper left, which is now the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery. William Wilson Corcoran, the Corcoran's founder, pictured in the middle, and Frederick Douglass in a wonderful photograph from the National Portrait Gallery's collection on the right. So there are three works of art in the collection of the now-dissolved Corcoran Gallery of Art that were meaningful to Frederick Douglass when he lived at Cedar Hill from 1878 until his death in 1895. And they were, as you will find out in the next few moments, and why, a painting by Émile Renouf, a French painter, called The Helping Hand, a copy of which is seen at the upper left. The original painting is now lost, not lost, sorry, it's unlocated. It was in the collection of the Corcoran Gallery of Art until it was deaccessioned in 1988. It was sold at auction, but I don't know where the painting is now. Excuse me, I have not been able to trace it. So this is a copy. Another painting at the lower left by Richard Norris Brooke from 1881, which is now in the National Gallery's collection from the Corcoran collection. And of course, the sculpture at the right, Hiram Powers' The Greek Slave, also from the Corcoran, in the Corcoran's collection for a very long time, actually a gift of William Wilson Corcoran. And that is also on view, actually, in a gallery just nearby to this lecture hall. So you can actually see the Brooke painting at the lower left and the Powers sculpture after the lecture, if you would like to. Both of the paintings, the Renouf and the Brooke, were purchased by the Corcoran in 1881. And as I mentioned, the Greek Slave was in Mr. Corcoran's original collection, given to the Corcoran when it opened in 1874. So all three of these works were in the Corcoran collection when Frederick Douglass visited the Corcoran, which is the bit of news that is a bit of new research that led to this talk. We know that Douglass had visited the Corcoran over his years in Washington, as evidenced by the presence in his library of these two collection catalogs, one from 1875 and one from 1890. And I'm grateful to Kamal for bringing these to my attention. Kamal's colleague Brittany Omley Hall brought to my attention, as I mentioned a year ago, this very interesting publication at the left, which is called, as you can see, the publication was called Anti-Caste. The particular article was by the editor, the founder and editor of this publication, Catherine Impey. The article was called Sketch of the Life of Frederick Douglass. Catherine Impey, who you see on the right, was a British Quaker activist against racial discrimination, and she founded this journal in March of 1888 and edited it until 1895. This final edition, of which you're seeing the front page on the left, published in April and May of 1895, is as a special memorial issue to Frederick Douglass, is the issue or the edition in which Catherine Impey published her sketch of the life of Frederick Douglass, as you can see. And within it, there were extracts from her diary when she visited Cedar Hill in Washington. She came from England, and she came in September of 1892 to visit Frederick Douglass. And when she came, she and Frederick Douglass and some other people visited the Corcoran Gallery, according to her reminiscences. And I'm showing you at the upper right an image of the Grand Salon, in what we now call the Renwick Building, and then the slides of the Brooke and the Renouf paintings to demonstrate what happened when Catherine Impey and Frederick Douglass visited the Corcoran. Impey wrote, quote, that she, quote, visited that art gallery near the White House, which only at that time could have been the Corcoran Gallery of Art, with Frederick Douglass and a party of six ladies. We were just starting when two more guests arrived, a Mrs. Lee and her daughter from Chicago, in parentheses colored, Miss Lee providing a skilled musician and singer. In the gallery, I went around with Mr. and Mrs. Douglass, and he pointed out to me his favorite pictures. Two he especially called my attention to were The Helping Hand, a merry, happy little child helping an old sailor grandfather to row the boat. The other, a sympathetically drawn household scene in a Negro cabin, in which there is an entire absence of the element of ridicule or caricature, so unusual in pictures of Negro, in American pictures of Negro life, end quote. Catherine Impey also wrote in her journal, the gallery, the Corcoran Gallery, closed at 4 o'clock, suggesting that the party had remained for the entire afternoon for quite some time. Some of the party went home, she reported. Others strolled through the White House gardens to enjoy the water lilies, foliage, plants, and shade, which is an image I just love of that we, of course, can't experience today to leave. Well, we can't experience leaving the Corcoran either, but certainly can't experience going over to the White House and walking through the gardens. But so just to give a little more detail on what Frederick Douglass in particular noted, as recorded by Catherine Impey, there's the again a copy of The Helping Hand, and you see it on view in a photograph probably not exactly of the same date, but certainly a vintage photograph of the Grand Salon at the Corcoran, now Renwick Gallery. The painting, The Helping Hand, which entered the collection in 1881 of the Corcoran and was deaccessioned in 1988. So it was a very captivating painting to visitors to Washington for more than 100 years, the silent concord between the old fisherman and his young helper, perhaps his daughter, more likely granddaughter, in a fishing boat with tarpaulin, fishing nets, and line, rowing silently. Rowing silently but in harmony with a single oar through calm waters in a placid sea. So this very kind of pastoral, romantic subject of a boat and rowing a boat and fishing. Of course, this is a very popular subject for particularly French, but also American painters and other painters in the late 19th century, I should say. Again, in my mind, circling back to what Kamel was telling us about Frederick Douglass and his love of art and of nature and of water in particular. Actually, Kamel, this is sort of late-breaking news for this group. The earlier lecture attendees did not hear this, but Kamel told me that he thinks that Frederick Douglass may have owned a small copy of the painting The Helping Hand, and it may be in the storage of the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site. So that is why this is truly a work in progress, because the two speakers have conversed about a possible additional piece of evidence that Douglass loved the painting on the right in particular. This painting, the French painting, was actually a hit, was it highly appraised at the Paris Salon of 1881, purchased by the Corcoran, that very year. And surely this idea of a struggle, albeit a peaceful struggle, must have been in the water, must have appealed to Douglass. I'm speculating completely because we don't have his words. We only have Catherine Impey's words to date. Surely there's much research still to be done. There's a larger image of the painting. And in large part, the popularity of The Helping Hand also came because it was one of the few works illustrated in the catalogs of the Corcoran's permanent collection, but it also appeared in many, many publications. There are two popular prints that you see here, publications like church bulletins and literary periodicals, travel articles about Washington, textbooks on the walls of grammar schools and hospital quarters, and even adapted for political cartoons. And I can tell you that in my 16 years as curator of American art at the Corcoran, we received many, many phone calls from people saying, where is The Helping Hand? That we could not answer because it is surely in a private collection, and I would like actually to do some more work to find out where it is now. This painting by Richard Norris Brooke, also noted by Frederick Douglass, as recorded by Catherine Impey, was of great interest to Douglass. And again, I'm thinking back to Kamel's research and presentation about Douglass's strong interest in the rustic his entire life. This painting was the most celebrated painting executed by Brooke, depicting an African-American family in their home, welcoming a pastor to Sunday dinner. By tradition, the pastor is served first at the table, and at the conclusion of the meal will be given gifts from the congregation, including a cigar box filled with money collected from the congregation that's being very protected, very much protected by the patriarch of the family. And this bundle of wrapped fruit here will be given to the pastor when he leaves the dinner. Of course, this is a very frequent occurrence perhaps somewhat earlier in the 19th century than 1881. This is potentially a sort of retrospective look back at a time when both black and white rural parishes that could not afford parsonages would have the pastors over to dinner. Kamel has talked today and at other times about Douglas and his great love for his family and the importance of having his family around him. So again, I'm speculating, but I feel that that's probably an area for further research and a reason that that Douglas would have been particularly attracted to this painting. Now, Richard Norris Brooke, the artist of this painting, like Douglas, was very concerned that there were many contemporary renderings in paint, and Douglas, I think, in paintings also, renderings of African Americans, in Brooke's words, as works of flimsy treatment and vulgar exaggeration. The artist of this painting was very concerned about the portrayal of African Americans, and he was very concerned that in the footsteps of Jules Breton and his recent French academic training, that he would be able to elevate a rural subject like this to a very truthful level that would dignify his subjects. Douglas, as we know also from Kamel's remarks, was very interested in not caricaturing African Americans, that and he was especially interested in photograph and used it in many ways, as we know, but was very concerned that that African Americans be portrayed in a very straightforward manner and not in any kind of exaggerated way. The Brooke painting was also a very popular painting and reproduced many times, and like The Helping Hand, hung in reproduction in homes of people and appeared in publications like Harper's Weekly. I've spoken to a number of people who remember growing up with the print of this painting in their homes. So what else would Douglas have seen in the Corcoran when he visited in 1892 with Catherine Impey? He could not have missed Hiram Power's sculpture, The Greek Slave, that you see here. And here is the Greek slave in a specially designed octagon over the front door of the Corcoran. Mr. Corcoran gave the sculpture to his museum. He commissioned James Renwick to build this octagonal gallery, which you can still go into. And that is where the sculpture was installed. We're looking, you would come up the grand staircase, for those of you who know the building, then you come back to the front, see the Greek slave, and beyond, see the grand gallery, the grand salon. You could not have missed the sculpture. I'm sure that Douglas did not. We don't, to date, have any recording of his having noticed the sculpture, but we knew that it was important to him because he owned a tabletop version of it in Perrionware. A very, you can see this when you go to Cedar Hill, as I did about 10 years ago. When I first visited, noticed the sculpture, and immediately went back to my office at the Corcoran and said, I'm keeping this because this will be important to a future research project. And lo and behold, this has sort of come back and is still a continuing research project. So there is the Greek slave on top of the piano in the parlor at Cedar Hill. And so we know it was certainly important to Douglas. And for those of you who don't know the background necessarily, Powers sculpted this very well-known, the first publicly exhibited life-size American sculpture depicting a fully nude female figure, American sculpture, which was incredibly successful both popularly and in a critical sense. And the work, Powers made the work, ostensibly, the subject inspired by Greece's struggle for independence in the 1820s, the Greek slave captured by the Turks. But in reality, many literary, artistic, and critical responses to the sculpture linked it to the ongoing debate over American slavery. And here you, on the right, you can see an explicit example of that. There are many, many others connecting the sculpture to the current events in our country. Mr. Corcoran, for his part, and I should say that we don't know that Mr. Corcoran and Frederick Douglass ever met, but Mr. Corcoran displayed the life-size sculpture in his home, in his mansion in Washington, where it attracted a huge amount of publicity before giving it to his museum. Douglass So here's the sculpture in the parlor in the center. By the way, this painting that Kamal showed is actually by Edmund Messer, who was the a principal of the Corcoran School of Art. So we know that Douglas had some connections to the Corcoran itself. And there, here is a version of the Parry and Ware sort of ceramic-like. I'm not going to go into detail about how it's made, but it's a tabletop version that's in the Metropolitan's collection at the right. Well, Douglas not only had this tabletop sculpture of the Greek slave in his home, he traveled with it. It was that important to him. It was so important to him that he took it with him to Haiti. And here it is in the background, just behind Douglas, seen in his office when he was ambassador to Haiti from 1889 to 1891, which I think is pretty interesting. And this is not a sort of sturdy object, right, Kamal? It's not something that we have to be very careful about it. So we think about traveling these days. Imagine about traveling back then and how carefully you would pack your belongings. So again, this is a work in progress because I still have much more to find out about whether Douglas and Mr. Corcoran met, the meaning of this particular sculpture. We don't know whether Douglas purchased it or received it as a gift. I would love to be able to find that out. And as a kind of final a coda to this presentation and just a collection of images that make me wonder how much more work there is to do about Frederick Douglass, not so much the art in his home that Kamal talked about, but how much interaction Douglass had with artists in Washington, perhaps Richard Norris Brooke, who painted The Pastoral Visit, who was a very active artist in Washington. And patronized by Mr. Corcoran, and what else Frederick Douglass might have seen at the Corcoran that would have held meaning for him. Just in the same way that he could not have missed the Greek slave, I am sure that he could not have missed Frederick Church's Niagara, which you see on the right of the screen, and you can also, I hope, see in better form, actual form, in our American Paintings galleries. So interesting thinking, again, circling back to Kamal's remarks about the importance of water as a metaphor for freedom. And the remarkable kind of the quotes that Kamal had about from 1843 when Douglas talked about visiting Niagara, which he did several times, including on his honeymoon, I learned today from Kamal, and the feeling that he gave to him to visit Niagara, which he compared with when his feet touched free soil. So again, I can only speculate on what Douglas must have thought when he saw this painting, and I'm sure he did, but we can also see, as we did in Kamal's talk, that that Douglas collected other images of Niagara Falls. Here's this stereograph that you can see in a viewer at Cedar Hill, and the Currier and Ives print just above. So I have, again, further work, further research to do, but to me, I mean, it's such an intriguing idea, and one that I'm so grateful to the folks at the Frederick Douglass National Historic Site for bringing to my attention this article about Douglass visiting the Corcoran. And given time and energy, I want to pursue this in more depth. So that is what I have to share with you. Thank you so much for coming.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.